Upon the docks, I found a man seeking passage to Liverpool. I explained my circumstances to him, and after a short negotiation, we swapped papers with one another. He gave my name to the ticketmaster, and I his. Should my father inquire at the custom house, the officers there will be able to show him proof that I have left these islands already and am returning home. But perhaps your father and your brother will come to the coast of their own accord, for the diggings. That I cannot predict, Moody agreed, but from what I understood of their current situation, they had made gold enough in Otago.
Gold enough?
Balfour seemed about to laugh again. Moody shrugged. Well, he said coldly, I shall prepare myself for the possibility of their arrival, of course, but I do not expect it.
No, of course,
Balfour said, patting Moody's sleeve with his big hand.
Let us now talk of more hopeful things. Tell me, what do you intend to do with your pile once you've amassed a decent sum? Back to Scotland, is it, to spend your fortune there?
So I hope, Moody said. I've heard that a man might make a competence in 4 months or less, which would take me away from here before the worst months of winter. Is that a probable expectation in your mind?
Quite probable, Balfour said, smiling at the coals. Quite probable indeed.
Yes, one might expect it.
No mates in town, then? Folk to meet you up on the quay? Join up? Lads from home?
None, sir, Moody told him for the third time that evening. I travelled here alone, and as I have said to you already, I intend to make my own fortune without the help of other men.
Oh, yes, said Balfour. Making your own. Well, going after it in the modern way. But a digger's mate is like his shadow. That's another thing to know. His shadow. Or his wife.
At this remark, there was a ripple of amusement around the room. Not open laughter, merely a quiet expulsion of breath issued from several quarters at once. Moody glanced around him. He had sensed a slackening in the air, a collective relief at the conclusion of his narrative. The men had been afraid of something, he thought, and his story had given them reason to put their fear aside. He wondered for the first time whether their trepidation was connected in some way to the horror he had witnessed aboard the Godspeed. The thought was strangely unpleasant. He did not want to believe that his private memory might be explicable to another man, and still less, that another man might share it. Suffering, he thought later, could rob a man of his empathy, could turn him selfish, could make him depreciate all other sufferers. This realization, when it came, surprised him. Balfour was grinning.
"Aye, his shadow or his wife," he repeated, nodding appreciatively at Moody, as though the jest had been Moody's rather than his own.
He stroked his beard several times with the cup of his hand and laughed a little. For he was indeed relieved. Lost inheritance, falseness in marriage, a high-born woman put to work. These betrayals belonged to a different world entirely, Balfour thought, a world of drawing-rooms and calling-cards and gowns. It was charming to him that such changes in fortune might be counted as tragedies, that the young man might confess them with the stern, controlled embarrassment of a man who had been taught to believe from the moment of his birth that his estate would never change. To speak of that here, at the vanguard of the civilized world. Hokitika was growing faster than San Francisco, the papers said, and out of nothing. Out of the ancient, rotting life of the jungle. Out of the tidal marshes and the shifting gullies and the fog. Out of sly waters rich in ore. Here the men were not self-made, they were self-making, as they squatted in the dirt to wash it clean. Balfour touched his lapel. Moody's story was pathetic, and had aroused in him an indulgent, fatherly feeling, for Balfour liked very much to be reminded that he himself was modern, entrepreneurial, unencumbered by connection, while other men still found it in the trappings of an outworn age. This, of course, was a verdict that said less about the prisoner than about the judge. Balfour's will was too strong to admit philosophy, unless it was of the soundest empirical sort. His liberality could make no sense of despair, which was to him as a fathomless shaft, possessed of depth but not of breadth, stifled in its isolation, navigable only by touch, and starved of any kind of curiosity. He had no real fascination with the soul, and saw it only as a pretext for the greater, livelier mysteries of humour and adventure. Of the soul's dark nights he had no opinion. He often said that the only inner void to which he paid any kind of notice was appetite, and although he laughed when he said it and seemed very well pleased, it was true that his sympathy rarely extended to situations where sympathy was expected to extend. He was indulgent towards the open spaces of other men's futures, but he was impatient with the shuttered quarters of their pasts.
"In any case," he went on, "mark this as your second piece of advice, Mr. Moody. Find yourself a friend. Plenty of parties about that'd be glad for an extra pair of hands. That's the way, you know. Find a mate, then form a party. Never known a man to make it solo. Are you kitted with a costume and a swag?"
"I'm afraid I am at the mercy of the weather on that count," Moody said. "My trunk is still aboard ship. The weather was too inclement to risk crossing the bar tonight, and I was told to expect my belongings at the custom house tomorrow afternoon. I myself was conveyed by lighter. A small crew rowed out very bravely to fetch the passengers in."
"Oh, yes," Balfour said more soberly. "We've seen 3 wrecks in the past month alone coming over the bar. It's a frightful business. There's a penny to be made in it, mind. When the ships are coming in, people don't pay too much attention, but when they're going out, there's gold aboard. I am told that the landing here at Hokitika is notoriously treacherous."
"Notoriously? Oh, yes. And there's nothing to be done about it if a vessel's on the long side of 100 feet. She might blow off a full head of steam, and it's not enough to force her over. Capital fireworks show, with the flares shooting up all around. But then, it's not just the steamers, not just the big ones. It's any man's game on the Hokitika bar, Walter. That sand will ground a schooner on the wrong tide."
"I well believe it," Moody said. "Our vessel was a bark, none too large, agile, hardy enough to weather the most dreadful of storms.